name is Afshin. I'm an addict.
Hi,
thanks for asking me. I don't really remember when, at what point in my life, I first had started taking a bit of responsibility for myself, but I always have this memory of being, of growing up, that I was always so dependent on everyone around me, because I don't really recall ever having a sense of ownership about myself, or even really having the strength or knowledge of how to take care of myself. It was kind of like, in many ways, a lot of things were done for me, and you know, I was really extremely shy when I was a kid. So I think my parents were my mom especially was super protective, but at the same time, my dad growing up was so judgmental, and everything I ever did was not good enough. He, you know, why the thinnest by the swimming pool? Why are you dressed like that? Why don't you play with the boys instead of with the girls? Why don't you? You know, everything was just questioned. And I remember just feeling, just wanting someone to like accept me for who I was, rather than question who was, you know. And when I was five, I was sent to boarding school. And I'm from Iran originally. And my parents were getting divorced, and so my dad decided he'll put us, me and my sister, in another country, in boarding school, so that they can deal with the divorce. And you know, when you're five, your cortex isn't developed yet, so you know, your ability to think is not, it's more reactive than you can't really think. So like if I'm in a supermarket and my mom goes around the corner and I'm 5 years old, I don't think she might be around the corner. I think, oh my God, I'm going to die. I've been abandoned, you know? So at 5 years old, I was sent to another country, and my mom didn't know. My dad, she found out from my dad's sister that he'd taken us out of the country without telling her. And she just thought we were on holiday in Iran somewhere. And I remember just the terror of being this five-year-old kid, and then at the airport, and then this woman came, I didn't know who she was, and she just took us, you know? And so we just had to follow her and do what she said, no idea what was going on or anything. And I was in boarding school for 4 years, in the first place I went to, and then and during that 4 years I went back to Iran once, so we were basically had to stay at school all the time. So and during that 4 years I saw my mom once, because they got divorced, and I remember she met another guy, and she came I was in Switzerland. She came to Switzerland to see me and my sister. And in the car, she shows us a picture of this guy, and she goes, "I see him. I'm getting married to him." And she'd met him 3 weeks before. And I think she was so terrified of her own life and what was going to happen to her, because she in Iran, the woman, and not knowing what was going on for her and stuff, that she just took a leap of faith and did something, which ultimately wasn't very good, because this guy ended up making my life hell growing up. But as I grew up, in my teens and stuff, I continued in boarding school. I was in boarding school in England. I was always somewhere else, and someone was always taking care of me in terms of telling me what to do, what time you eat, what time you do this. I just couldn't think for myself, and I never really learned. And then I started getting extremely bullied in high school, you know, I literally would have to like choose different corridors to go, because I was so terrified of who I was going to run into. And even though I'm quite relatively light skinned or whatever, and you know, people would hold their nose behind me and call me Paki and this and that. So I had a lot of racism as well. And you know, by the time I got to university when I was 18, for the first time, I started having drugs and alcohol, and I went to university in America, which my university is probably one of the highest drug using universities in America, so really well known for that, and accepted. And even in our student handbook, it would have all the drugs listed and what the effects are and how they worked and everything, and so all of a sudden, I just got released from my head. You know, I was like, oh my God, I can talk to people. My sister was always the popular one, and she had so many friends. And I used to say to my parents, "How does she do it? How does she, you know, why is she so popular? Why am I so shy and scared of everything?" And all of a sudden I discovered drugs and alcohol, and I wasn't anymore. And I suddenly started having this, like, and I loved it, you know, I really enjoyed it. And I started being the one that started having friends. And of course I'm not going to go, you know, from someone who comes from this timid, shy little boy to all of a sudden being popular, and more popular than my sister had ever been, even, then all of a sudden I just felt like this was an achievement. And I just went, I really went crazy with it. And I remember, you know, at the first it was like ecstasy and things like that. And then I remember my first line of coke I ever took, and I remember I just felt nothing. And I thought in my head that it would feel like the euphoria of something like ecstasy. And I just thought, oh, this isn't for me. And little did I know that fast forward however many years, and that was my drug of choice. And I was using 5 grams to 6 a day. I was in my flat, and I was living in Paris by then. I was locked in my flat. I would go for lunch with my friends, and even though they were all casual users, they weren't aware of how I was using. And I would go to the toilet, come back, and then all I'd do is keep looking at my watch because I was so nervous to not go and then realize that I'm going. Why am I keep going to the toilet or whatever? And I'd use all week, and then it would be like the weekend, and my friends were like, "Let's get some coke," and I'd be like, "Okay." And then we'd go out, and like 3 or 4 in the morning, we'd get home. They'd be like, "Okay, good night, go to bed." I'd be like, "Okay." And then 3 or 4 days later, I was still going. And during this time, my door was like a revolving door. I was on all the sex apps and things, and like I had like 3 on my phone, 2 on my computer, like, you know, and all of them at once going. And guy after guy after guy would be coming. And you know, by this point, you know, I took a lot of risks in my life, and I became HIV positive not because of this stuff. It was more, I don't really know how, to be honest. I think it was possibly from this situation that sort of was sort of like a rape. But when I got it in 1992, and this was a time when people were still dying, you know, the doctor told me that you're going to die. I have nothing to give you except AZT, which at the time was the only medication. And he said it's got this effect, this side effect, this side effect, this side effect, this side effect. But everybody I've given it to has died, so I just have to let you know. And I'm like, well, why would I take something so poisonous and toxic if I'm going to die anyways? So in my head, I just took it like a death sentence. And I thought, well, I'm just going to like really try and be healthy and not take drugs and not. And for a while, I did it, you know, but it didn't work, you know. And my viral load started going up. And when I first told my dad, you know, when I told him I was HIV positive, he told me that he didn't believe me because he said, "You're always lying, so why would I believe you?" And when I told him I was gay, he spat in my face. He went to the toilet a few times, I think, to throw up. He came back and he you know, he said, "We're going to get you cured." And then, so I grew up with a lot of this stuff around me. But at the same time, my dad was always quite, it's a really weird situation because I knew he loved me at the same time. You know, it was this dichotomy between this love that existed and this crazy behavior and this crazy like pressure over me. And you know, in recovery, I've discovered that, you know, I mean, he was part of this Iranian culture that's Muslim, and they have their rules and their expectations, and not to justify it, but I also know that he was trying his best, you know, and with what he knew how. You know, his dad was 10 times worse, so and trauma passes on 2 or 3 generations. So I'm conscious that today that he did his best, but it was very difficult. So, but by the time I was in Paris using my room and stuff, mm-hmm. with all of this, you know, behind me to use on, I started texting my best friend and my dad simultaneously, minute by minute messages of what I was doing and what I was feeling, because I felt like every time I was doing it, I couldn't remember the next when I woke up from a binge, what had happened, and I felt like somebody needed to know. And my best friend was in New York, my dad was in Canada, and it was really horrible. It was like I was writing things like, you know, I just got fucked by this many guys, and I don't know, and I'm really, I feel like I've got these diseases like in my body. I feel them crawling around me, like, you know, it's not, a father doesn't want to read that stuff, you know, but I had to have someone read them, because I needed someone. Like today, they're actually like my father kept those messages and I transcribed them, and they're like my, they're almost like a step one for me. And it's so, it's when I read them today, I still cry because they were so poignant and so reflective of what my actual feelings were at that given moment and stuff. I ended up, my best friend, one day I was using, crying, whatever, there was a knock on the door. I opened the door and my best friend had given up his job for a few weeks and shown up at my doorstep from New York in Paris, and I just fell into his arms crying. And he was like, he just come to help me. He's a therapist, he's helped a lot of people with drugs and alcohol and stuff. And he's the one who slowly nudged me into accepting that I was an addict. You know, there was a long time where I just would think that I still could stop whenever I wanted to, but reality was I'd gotten past the point I even believed it myself, you know. And he got my mom to come. I threw her out because I felt so guilty. He got my dad to come. You know, slowly got me to treatment, got me to the rooms, to step by step. You know, and I came in ready because I got to a point where I felt anything was better than what I was going through. And I'm the sort of person that needs to understand things to adopt them into my life. So I did need to go through that process where I traumatized my therapist by just like constantly asking questions and why. But I wanted them to convince me. I was ready to be convinced. And I was ready to surrender to something. And I did it, you know, and everything, I got through each step and I got through each part of the convincing process. And I got to a point where I started doing really well. And, you know, I'm 4 years and 5 months now. Thank you. And you know, I haven't relapsed so far. I don't say that it's not something that might happen or not. I know that I have no qualms that if I ever relapse, I'm going to die. I have no qualms about it. Worse than if I die is that I stay alive in that state, you know? I don't want to be living dead. I don't want to exist through my life. I want to live through my life, you know? And I've put in a lot of effort. I've done the steps. I've got a couple of sponsees. I've got an amazing sponsor, which I chose because I really related not only to, he didn't have just what I wanted, but he was the sort of person that I knew I could understand and relate to, which was very important for me. You know, my life in addiction was fear of the future, always blaming my dad for everything, scared of my own shadow, always sad, desperate for love, desperate for, you know, I'd have relationships where every relationship, I'd force them to be the person I needed them to be so that I could feel better about myself. Like, I wouldn't see them for who they were and be intimate with them. I just wanted them to be who I needed them to be so that I could exist, you know? And my life in recovery is the opposite, you know? I'm not so scared of the future on a good day. I've let go of most of the things of my past. I realized that it doesn't matter where this stuff came from, whether it's my dad's fault or whoever's fault. It's my emotional legacy, and the only person that has something to do that can do something about it today is myself. And I take full responsibility for that. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.